You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Check out Ear to the Streets of Portland with hosts Sequoina
and Kayla
every first and third Thursday of the month starting at 7 o'clock p.m.
Listen in as we interview community organizers, speak on issues focused on Black Portland, and share community events happening in the area and elsewhere.
Listen on the radio at 90.7 FM, online at www.kboo.fm, or from your mobile phone at m.kboo.fm.
Follow KBOO on Instagram at KBOO Radio. Ear to the Streets.
Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, Professor Ron Lopez, Chicano and Latino Studies at Sonoma State University, speaks out against the repression and intimidation now being felt by many of his brown students. Also, we'll have an extensive update on the expanding U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza, where people are starting to starve to death as U.S. and Israeli security operatives brandish food as a weapon of war. We all know what the ribs of a starving person look like. Meanwhile, Bibi is in Washington, D.C., looking for more weapons handouts for his final solution. Yeah, Medea Benjamin will join us to talk about that. She's been trying to hold these war criminals accountable. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We broadcast to you every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network. That's KPFA here in the Bay Area where we originate from. And we are happy to have you along today on Free Speech, No Holds Barred, Truth to Power Radio. We have been doing this since 1949. We are happy to have you along with us. And we are happy, Miguel and I are happy to welcome back to these airwaves Professor Ron Lopez. He is a marvelous professor. He is a wonderful teacher for many young people for many years at Sonoma State University. Ron, these are tough times for the students that you teach. And Miguel and I definitely wanted to have you back to talk about the situation. Now, maybe you can give us your perspective on what the scene looks like now for you and the community that you work with and the students that you teach.
Well, thank you, Gavilan and Dennis, for the introduction. And yes, it's a very interesting time to be teaching, especially to be teaching in ethnic studies. There has been a concerted effort to attack ethnic studies for many years. Actually goes back, one of the earliest examples you might remember is in 1996, two teachers at Vaughn Junior and Senior High School in New Mexico were suspended for teaching Chicano. They were talking about Cesar Chavez, and they were suspended from their jobs as a consequence. Now, fast forward, more recently, we've had, with the Trump administration attacking DEI, which stands for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. I think it's very important when people say, you know, they're against DEI, which becomes sort of a code word. We have to say, so, you know, you're against equity, you're against inclusion, because that's what those programs call for. We are teaching ethnic studies, and ethnic studies, the field, is Asian American Studies, African American Studies, Native American Studies, and Chicano Latino Studies. And, you know, sometimes these things have different names. Asian American Studies sometimes gets called Southwest Asia and North Africa Studies, or SWANA, to include the broader Middle East. This has been a point of contention. And in the year, you know, but there have been efforts and attacks on ethnic studies for many years. It was during the 1990s, mostly, that students protested at UCs, and in some cases earlier on other campuses. Some of the early campuses were Claremont campuses, CSU Northridge, CSU, Sonoma State, also Los Angeles, and there are a few other early ones. But the ethnic studies programs have been attacked, and finally, there was a bill in 2020 called California Assembly Bill 1460, which required 3 units of ethnic studies classes for students at California State University. The University of California followed suit with a similar policy. And the state of California and educators in the state of California came up with a number of ethnic studies curriculums. One of them is called the Ethnic Studies Model Curriculum. And this is a very, how would I say, milquetoast, moderate, bland version of ethnic studies. Liberated Ethnic Studies, and you can go to liberatedethnicstudies.org if you're interested, has a radical political agenda. I would say, let's just call it a truthful instructional content, because it tells the truth about things like slavery and the genocide of Native Americans, and colonialism and conquest, and things like settler colonialism would include the United States and Australia and New Zealand and other places as well, South Africa. And but it also and we don't even have to talk about that state in the Middle East, north of Egypt, but it also ends up, you know, covering that partially because when you teach people about these phenomena, oh, you know, people go and they, you know, occupy land where there's other people already living, people come to their own conclusions. And part of the purpose of ethnic studies is to provide students with a critical understanding of race relations, power relations, the history of different ethnocultural groups and how they all overlap. We call that intersectionality, because the history of Native Americans, Chicanos, Latinos, Asian Americans, and African Americans are in North America and South America are deeply intertwined, and they're intertwined around the globe, and they're intertwined with things like the slave trade, the displacement, genocide of Native Americans, especially in Canada and the United States. In some other countries as well. We, you know, include things like the teaching about the colonization and conquest of Hawaii by American settlers. And so the Liberated Ethnic Studies curriculum, again, liberatedethnicstudies.org for those of you who are interested, really does an excellent job of providing this kind of critical, incisive, and very... And it wakes you up when you study this stuff and you realize, you know, the connections between these different places. I've actually been out of the country. I just got back from the Philippines. But one thing many people don't know is that the Spanish Empire included the Philippines for over 200 years. And while Mexico was New Spain, the Philippines was New Castile, and they were run together as a single unit. And the galleon trade was the trade between the two places that shipped gold from the Aztecs and Incas to Asia to buy trade goods, and then it was shipped back across the Pacific, and then, you know, fine goods were then shipped off to Europe. It was the Portuguese controlled the route around Africa. And so this, you know, the what has happened most recently, of course, is that the current president, the current POTUS, has declared war on all things woke, quote unquote. He makes that into a bad word. Being woke is a good thing. It's a great thing. And there have been several laws that have been passed, or several lawsuits that have been passed, in particular by groups such as the Deborah Project and the Canary Mission, which have accused Liberated Ethnic Studies curriculum of being anti-Semitic. And I'm going to argue that nothing, it could not be further from the truth. We do teach the truth of history in the Middle East, but teaching the truth of what a nation state does is not the same as teaching to hate a group of people, just like we can study the history of the United States or of Europe, let's say Belgium and the Congo, or, you know, many other places, the British in Australia. We can look at these things comparatively, and we can say, you know, what these people did, the displacement of the Aborigines, the genocide in the Congo by King Leopold, what happened here in both North and South America, Hawaii, and also what's currently happening in the Middle East. We can teach about the historical facts and the power dynamics involved without talking about personalized hostility towards a group of people because of who they are. I mean, I have family.
Let me just jump in here, Ron. Let me just interrupt for a second, Ron.
Please.
Ron, let me interrupt and say that you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's Professor Ron Lopez, who we are learning a great deal from, as we do every time he comes to visit us here at Flashpoints. Ron, we want to hear more about this. But as I listen to your sort of bringing the world together in this discussion, because it feels like we're slowly zooming in here. I think about my poetry teacher, Muriel Rukeyser, who wrote this poem called Islands. And the first line is, "Oh, for God's sake, they are connected underneath." And what we learn when we're able to study many cultures is what's going to save us, right? As we try and take on the war machine. Now, please pick up where the battle is now. And I also want to hear the implications for your students.
Well, where the battle is right now, it's all connected. It's all connected because we're part of a world system. The battle right now is that the federal government is defunding or threatening to defund educational institutions as well as civic organizations and taking them up, taking over, for example, the Kennedy Center, things of that sort, and defunding arts and other institutions nationwide. And students... the students are going to be affected by all of these things. The attacks on ethnic studies are especially egregious, in part because, the attacks are based on untruthful ideas, first of all. It is a smear campaign on one level. But also for students taking these classes or for students doing this work, and then going out into the world, there's already a chilling effect on free speech. Some of us are willing to speak out, but many people are, you know, deeply concerned about, you know, losing their jobs or even being, you know, deported, including people who aren't even undocumented. And I think what's happening right now, and we're seeing both the Canary Mission and the Deborah Project, these are both two Zionist organizations who are attacking the Liberated Ethnic Studies model curriculum, and they're pushing for this more, again, moderate ethnic studies model curriculum that was adopted by the state of California in 2021. People can go on the Liberated Ethnic Studies website and see the curriculum for themselves. But I think that the threat to funding educational institutions, to defunding all kinds of programs, they're talking about defunding Pell Grant. Linda McMahon, who was a wrestling promoter, took over after her husband passed away, is currently in charge of education and is not, you know, not really, I don't believe, and I think most informed people don't really believe she's qualified to manage education, but she's a loyalist to current POTUS, and because of that, she has that position. And the conservatives have, and the MAGA party has majority in both houses for now. And this is a real, it's a real challenge for us going forward. Now, I think that we've actually, and I'll, let me give you a concrete example of how these challenges are taking place. At the CSU, I work at Sonoma State, and I know this is happening in some programs at Sonoma State and also in other programs. The dismantling of things like DEI, the earlier dismantling of affirmative action, you know, this was, we were replaced by other programs, things like first generation programs. And a lot of that, especially with the threats to Pell Grant, a lot of that is being attacked right now. And that is going to affect students. The other dynamic that's affecting students is that we're seeing a disenrollment in schools and, you know, in higher education, because the population of the United States right now has more older people than younger people. And so the schools, the populations of many schools are actually shrinking. There's fewer students. And then many of those students want to get a, you know, regular job, or they're going to trade school, or they're going to the community college route. And so there's a diminishing of the prestige and motivation for some people in the current generation to pursue a higher education. And we're really going to need that expertise in a couple of years. And this, one of the problems that higher education did not address when it should have is this demographic change, because a UCLA professor, a professor of public health and Chicano studies, David Hayes Bautista, predicted this population shift back in the 1980s. I mean, he didn't project it. I mean, he didn't predict it. He projected it because you could see what was happening. And so there are threats on many levels. So what can we do? Well, we can support these programs at our local schools. We can take classes and learn and inform ourselves. They're trying to make it hard for us to do things like have the 1619 Project. If the government doesn't want you to read the 1619 Project, I would encourage, and right now the government doesn't want us to read that, I want to encourage every listener to go out. And I know it's an expensive book. You can get it in the public library, and you can get it on audiobook format. Listen to it in your car. You don't have to sit down with a big old hardback and read the book. But I think we have to resist this effort. Why are they trying so hard to make us not think these things, to make us not know these things? And I'm mentioning 1619 Project, which is about African American. Although I'm in Chicano studies, I could mention books from every different subset of ethnic studies. And really, at the four ethnic studies groups, Chicano Latino studies, African American Black studies, Asian and Southwest Asian North Africa studies, and Native American Indigenous Studies, really those are the four ones. So sometimes we'll say, well, why aren't, say, Armenians included in this? And it's this movement emerged out of a fight for access, the fight for inclusion in the university, specifically at San Francisco State and UC Berkeley in 1968 through 1969. But there was also the Black Power movement, the American Indian movement, the Chicano movement, the Young Lords back east as a Puerto Rican. And so we're this is part of a scholarly tradition, an epistemological tradition, meaning how we think about the field. The field has a coherent set of ideas. And the final thing I'll say is, I know it's really hard to vote for some of these conservative Democrats, but the alternative is to sit home and allow the conservatives to win. So I want to advocate that people go out and vote, and not just for your senator and your assemblyman, but like the local offices, your city council persons, the state assembly. All of these are important because the person who starts off as a city councilman, like say Ed Roy Ball, then becomes a congressman for most of his life. And, then Lucille Roy Ball Allard, his daughter, served many years in Congress. So it's important that we vote at every level and also get out and participate and be part of your local community civic action efforts to defend our communities and to defend our neighbors.
That is the voice of Professor Ron Lopez, Sonoma State University. Ron, we've been talking to you, Miguel and I, for many years. It's always enlightening to have you on, incredibly important now. And Miguel Gavilan Molina, our senior producer, certainly has a comment and a question for you.
It's good to hear your voice, Professor Lopez, being with us. You know, one of the biggest concerns, I just want to add to what you were telling us about, you know, the government and its reaction to EEI and, of course, ethnic studies and, you know, across the country, and particularly in the Southwest. But I also wanted to add that the governor, the current governor, Gavin Newsom, in the last, I believe, half a dozen years, there's been attempts here in California to bring ethnic studies and make it available, I believe, to the graduating class of high schoolers and also junior colleges. And that has been twice it's reached his desk, and I believe twice he has vetoed that. And it's always been a concern.
Actually, AB 101 was passed in October 2021. And students beginning this academic year, 25-26, this coming academic year, will be required to take one semester of an ethnic studies class. And I believe the junior colleges also now have a requirement. So this has been implemented. The problem is that, like all American politicians, it's not, you know, standing up for the rights of free speech when it may touch on the, you know, the U.S. Israel relationship. This is verboten. This is forbidden. And so people like Newsom always side with the more conservative version. That's why the ethnic studies model curriculum was passed and not liberated the ethnic studies .org curriculum. And that's why I'm making the distinction between those two things. At the same time, there are ongoing lawsuits against this material and against the actual faculty that are behind it. So several of my friends and colleagues around the state have been doxxed, meaning their personal data was put out on the internet so people could harass them. Some have lost their jobs. Some have been sued, both as an organization, the Red Ethnic Studies, and also the individuals involved were sued. And it's a real here's what I want people to take away from that. First of all, they're trying so hard for us not to think certain thoughts. And I think we should all know what it is people are trying to have us, to convince us not to think or know. That's one thing. But the other thing is, the fact that they are coming against us so hard, and they are, and they're spending millions and millions of dollars to do this, is the reason they're coming at us so hard is because we're being successful. It's working. Our ideas matter. Our ideas are compelling. Ethnic studies is revelatory. And every year, a couple of my graduates are not ethnic minorities. They're white people who have decided to either major or minor in ethnic studies because that's what they feel inspired by it. They feel inspired by the knowledge. That's been the case for years. And that's the case across the state. So we are seen as people with effective ideas, and this is one of the reasons why these powerful groups are fearful, because they are fearful of the truth, and they are fearful that if people really took critical knowledge to the next level and acted on it, it could, we might actually have even more success.
And that could be a threat to their power structure. One other question I have, Professor Lopez, and that is that Sonoma State in the last, year or so has been under a lot of pressure, the whole issue of free speech. And I also know that at that time, even to most recently, it was in a massive financial crunch, with that, having to cut back departments, having to let staff go, teachers go, et cetera, et cetera. Where is that at this point? Because I heard through the grapevine that some grant or some monies came in to the campus to take that, kind of like crisis, off of everybody's, concern. What is happening with that?
So I have to get the latest, but yes, we, not just Sonoma State, but the CSU and Sonoma State, we did get an infusion of funds. They were trying to cut the budget, the original budget cut. And this is in addition to the fact that we are down from our peak enrollment about 40%. So that's already a problem. But again, this is a consequence of poor administrative planning, because again, we knew that demographic change was happening. But then it was going to be 3%, and the final bill, the final appropriation, did not cut money or cut very little. Some people have already been let go. Departments like Women and Gender Studies have been discontinued and dismantled. We no longer have French studies or German language studies. A number of other master's degree programs have been cut. So it is, and there's been some proposals to retool and make us more technocratic oriented. But ethnic studies was saved. We were forced to consolidate from three departments into one. And we brought languages, which is now just the Spanish language instruction. We brought that along with us. And there was a whole reorganization of the campus. But fortunately, some of the firings were rescinded. And hopefully with appropriate planning and recruiting, we'll be back on our feet in the next year or two. But
all
yeah,
right. I need to jump in here because we're running out of time. Miguel Gavilan Molina is senior producer on Flashpoints. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We're just got a minute left, and Ron, I wanted to get in, give you a chance to maybe give us a sense through a story of how your students are being affected directly, and what some of them might be doing in terms of just defending themselves or being careful, or give us a sense of how the atmospheric pressure has changed.
Yeah, I think one of the things we're seeing is an attack on free speech. I make a point of really encouraging free speech. And of course, if you encourage free speech, that means people are going to say things that you disagree with rather strongly. So that happens to me quite a bit, which I welcome because that is part of the process. When they say that we're shutting down conversation, that is not the case. We're opening up the conversation. They talk about these ideas of censorship, or that we're, you know, putting blame on white students or something of that sort. But no, we are trying always to keep things open. But there is a sense of people want to graduate faster. People want to really focus on getting finished and moving on. And a lot of students are thinking, increasingly we're seeing about professional careers. And there's been a shift. I'm also a laborer in the labor union, the California Faculty Association. So I see this with a lot of young people who are thinking more about going into things like labor apprenticeship programs, let's say the plumbers, the pipe fitters union. And that's actually something that we're seeing on the rise with a decline in interest in higher education. Economic instability has something to do with this, of course. And but I think that there's always going to be a core of students who are committed to self-improvement, making their families proud, becoming successful in areas that they want. One of the things we do is we help students become involved in local civic organizations and take on, you know, public service. I mean, that's actually an assignment in my class, to go out and be, you know, participate in some way with some kind of organization, any organization.
You're also a dad. Does this come into that role now? You're a teacher, a father?
Yes. And I have, I worry about, both my kids are one's already in junior college and one of them is a high schooler. But, you know, yes, and I think that because both I and their mother are no longer together, but we are very strongly united for the well-being of our kids. So we're doing everything in our power to make sure that they have as many opportunities as are available in this day and age. And it's a challenge, but I think it's always a challenge for parents. And certainly as a person of color, the mother of my children is also a woman of color. So we have children that are children of color, and what this shift towards white supremacy nationally means for them and for the rest of us, it remains to be seen. But we're going to keep fighting.
Amazing. Well, we are always, Miguel and I are always honored to have you with us and to be able to share you with our audience. So please, Professor Ron Lopez, keep us posted. We want to know everything that's going on.
Thank you so much. It's going to be an honor. It's entirely mine. I'm so glad to have the opportunity to share this with everybody. And thank you both for calling me.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
Okay. Thank you for listening to.
Yeah. Some would say, si se puede. We appreciate your time.
Si se puede.
You're listening. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Dennis Bernstein with Miguel Gavilan Molina. We're going to take a break, And yes, we're turning our attention back to the ongoing expanding genocide that now includes starvation and really using food as a weapon of war that, like, I've never seen before. You're listening to Flashpoint. Stay tuned. Jennifer Lowenstein. She's a former Associate Director of Middle Eastern Studies, Senior Lecturer at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. More to the point, she knows what's going on the ground in Gaza, spent time there herself, and shares her knowledge with us on a regular basis now. There are so many things going on. We've got Bibi back in D.C., at a time where Israel has been bombing Yemen, all hell breaking loose, Lebanon, not to mention this slaughter, this sort of this new use of food as a weapon of war, and as the world watches. It unfolds, and people, we see their ribs, don't we? We're seeing the ribs. We know what starvation looks like.
Yeah, we do. And a number of children in Gaza now have died from malnutrition, which, and it's inevitable. I mean, baby formula is not getting into the strip. So mothers who can't breastfeed because they're malnourished look to formula to feed their infants, but there's no formula. So they're feeding them a liquid made of chickpeas and lentils, which isn't necessarily good for babies. So it's a pretty horrible situation. Today, as you mentioned, Netanyahu is in Washington, D.C. with Trump. In fact, I just watched a video of the private dinner going on at the White House, in which Netanyahu handed Trump a letter nominating him for the Nobel Peace Prize. The dinner itself looks like a good old boys club, people patting themselves on the back. All of this is happening while there are alleged ceasefire talks going on in Doha, Qatar. And, of course, those are over for the day. It's much later there. But despite these constant reports you get in the Western press of ceasefire deals being negotiated and people, if you actually read and listen to the people on the ground, they're no closer to a ceasefire deal today than they were 6 months ago. You know, people can point to, well, there was this ceasefire in January, but that was because of a single phone call by Witkoff saying you have to have a ceasefire. But then he backtracked. So anyway, what are the key issues in the ceasefire? One, humanitarian aid. Hamas is saying they want the United Nations back in the strip to distribute humanitarian aid. The Israelis are saying nothing doing. It's the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, so named, it, or nothing. And that's an organization, as listeners probably know, that is run by Israel and the United States. It's manned by American mercenaries, and both Israeli soldiers and these mercenaries have now admitted to firing into these crowds of hungry people who come for aid just randomly. They fire into, kill 5, 20, 100 people a day, and this is happening regularly now. So humanitarian aid is one thing. The second thing is that Hamas wants there to be clearer and more precise language around an end, negotiations to end the war. 60-day ceasefire is, you know, it's 60 days of not bombing, supposedly. But Hamas wants this war to end. And it's very ironic, but that's one of the things Israel is refusing to go to. Hamas also wants there to be an Israeli troop withdrawal and redeployment from Gaza. Israel is saying no to that as well. It is currently occupying between 70% and 80% of the Gaza Strip, with populations now overflowing on the western edge up by the sea, especially in Al-Mawasi. On top of this, so it doesn't look like we're very close to a ceasefire.
In those talks in Doha, the Israelis didn't even send their chief negotiator. They sent a member, I believe, of Shin Bet, if I'm remembering correctly.
That's typical. They will often send someone there who is capable of talking or setting down points or discussing something, but who is not capable of making any decisions. So it's really a farce for the entire world to watch, because nothing is really happening. And as the author of Jeremy Scahill pointed out in an article this morning, basically what happens in Doha is secondary to what happens tonight and tomorrow in Washington, D.C., between Netanyahu and Trump. Of course, there are other commentators who are saying that all of this media publicity around Netanyahu's visit and the focus on Gaza is misplaced, because what they're really going to discuss is Iran and possibly Lebanon, and that leads to another whole subject. But in the meantime, there's no question that, and this is reported in a number of places today, that there are concentration camps being developed in the area between Rafah and the Morag Corridor, which is just a few kilometers north of Rafah. And that is where the Israelis are hoping to put 600,000 Palestinians in what they're calling a humanitarian transit area before they ask them to leave. And if you listen to the language, it's for people not accustomed to this, you know, it's wonderful to sanitize what you're doing by saying humanitarian and transit, and we want to give the Palestinians a choice. Well, what are the real choices? The choices, because now they're saying, oh, anyone who wants to stay in Gaza can stay. And they sound so sincere. What are the real choices? You can leave. You can languish in a world where you don't have sufficient food, you don't have sufficient water, you don't have sufficient, if any, health care. You know, basically, you languish in conditions that are subhuman, or you die. Those are the three choices that we are giving Palestinians in these concentration camps, and frankly, in all of Gaza right now. Leave, languish, or die. That's as clear as anyone can say it. The last thing in the ceasefire agreement that I should mention is that after everything is agreed to, theoretically in some other universe, Trump will hand Netanyahu a letter giving him permission to break the ceasefire at any time he judges that it's not holding the way he wants it to hold. So the whole thing is really a farce. It's all being decided by a handful of people in Washington, D.C., not in Doha. not in Tel Aviv, and certainly not by Hamas. And what we're seeing are the mechanisms by which Israel and the GHF, which is also American run, are essentially carrying out a massive displacement operation on top of the constant genocide, the constant killing. And what we're going to see more and more of in the next few months is this, or is the machinery for displacement being put into place on the ground, both inside and outside of Gaza. They're talking about Egypt, talking about the Negev Desert. Who knows? But I'm still hearing this language of, we're looking for a place, a country that will host. I like that, Palestinians, and find them a better future. This is how the language of ethnic cleansing and mass displacement and mass misery is being clothed. It's very depressing.
And just talk a little bit about the situation. I am interested in the context. Obviously, they're going. The settlers are out of control in the West Bank. It's so that's a whole other story that we're not hearing very much about.
Right,
this is a brutal, violent situation where settlers are setting up their own checkpoints, they're armed, and they're shooting people if they feel like it.
And they have not been stopped by the IDF or IOF. In fact, I remember last week that settlers actually attacked an Israeli military base. Apparently, because the military base wasn't giving them free rein to be as murderous as they wanted to be. I think the one bit of news that I read today that I thought was distressing is that West Bank home demolitions are at their highest since 1967. So we're seeing, for example, 100 homes being demolished today in Tulkarm. The Jenin refugee camp has already been completely hollowed out. I don't think anyone's living there now.
What exactly is a home demolition? What is a home? How does that work? What is a home demolition? Do people just show up and blow up your house?
Basically, a destruction crew shows up. They order everybody out. And they rig the house upstairs and downstairs if it happens to be multi-story, with explosives, and they go outside and they detonate the explosives and the whole thing is blown up. So your entire life and all your memories and all of your furniture and all of your souvenirs and photographs and everything else, everything is destroyed. Everything that you can't carry out it with your own hands in the 10 minutes you're given to leave.
Would those be U.S. weapons that are blowing?
I would imagine they are. I mean, I would imagine so, especially since around these demolition sites, you often see bulldozers, and that, of course, points to Caterpillar. Caterpillar has been giving the Israeli Army D9 armored bulldozers for, over 30 years. And there have been plenty of protests here in the United States, but hasn't stopped them from doing so. A lot of listeners will remember that Rachel Corrie was killed when she was run over by a D9 armored bulldozer in Rafah in 2003. There were lots of protests then. But yeah, most of this stuff is being carried out by U.S.-made weapons. 70% of the weaponry that Israel is using to carry out this genocide are coming directly from the United States, unimpeded, no holds barred. Nothing is being held up right now.
Well, listen, we always appreciate the information, although we're not happy what it sounds like and what's going on here in this heavily funded and supported U.S.-Israeli genocide. We should say we're going to continue our discussion in a moment with Medea Benjamin, who is trying to hold the these folks, the killers, accountable in Washington, D.C. and places east of here. Thank you, Jennifer, for taking the time out. Jennifer Lowenstein, former Associate Director of Middle Eastern Studies and Senior Lecturer at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, a good friend of this show. Thanks for the information and the time, Jennifer.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I think we've got Medea on the line. Medea, are you with us?
Yes. Hello, Dennis.
Welcome back to Flashpoints. It is always a pleasure and an honor to have you with us. So what's your reaction to Netanyahu in Washington, D.C.? I was just told, I haven't seen it with my own eyes, but that Netanyahu gave him a letter nominating him for a Nobel Peace Prize.
Oh, God, please. It's just surreal, Dennis. You know, three times since Trump is back in office, every time I think, no, he's not really coming here, and then he is. And we've had protests starting yesterday in the evening in front of the White House, and then today starting early in the morning, all day today, big one tonight, and tomorrow he's going to be in Congress, so we're preparing protests there. And we just feel like, you know, it's not a slogan to say that he belongs in The Hague. It's real. If there were any justice in this world, if there were any international law being obeyed, he would definitely not be here. So we're disgusted. We're giving him the unwelcome, whatever we can. And we did have a very spirited protest out tonight with about 15 different groups that joined in. And we'll be following him around everywhere he goes. Tomorrow he's meeting with the head of the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, even though the House is in recess. And then he's going to meet with the leadership, both Republican and Democrat, in the Senate tomorrow. And of course, as you know, Dennis, this is a bipartisan disaster. So, he gets to meet with the leadership of both parties. And, you know, it's a bit surreal. We're all waiting for some announcement about a ceasefire, but people are not feeling very optimistic.
So, and just to be clear here, our problem isn't only the Republicans when we're talking about this issue. Many of the Democratic senators, Chuck Schumer, these are cheerleaders for genocide. So your struggle is bipartisan. I want you to talk a little bit about why you oftentimes, Medea, step over the line, why you commit civil disobedience, and what that feels like to you.
I think it's funny you say that I step over the line. I mean, it's, you know, Israel and the genociders that step over the line. We're well within the line when it comes to moral clarity. We have people constantly getting arrested. We have to measure our arrests because if you get too many, you get banned from Congress, and that will not help for those of us who are there every day. So we need new people. And for the new people, it's not a huge deal to get arrested in Congress. It's pretty much it takes a couple of hours and you pay a fine. But the more you get arrested, the harder it is. And we wait until there are hearings that are important hearings. So if you have a Secretary of Defense or Secretary of State, or one of these generals, or, you know, somebody who represents power, we want to be able to speak out. And it's because of a number of things. I mean, one is even the Democrats don't ask the questions that we'd want to ask or in the way we'd want to ask them. And we think it's important for people around the world to see that there are Americans standing up to our quote, leaders, and I put that in quotes because, as you well know, Dennis, and your listeners, I'm sure, know, they don't represent us. And the opinion polls just keep going more and more in favor of Palestine, away from support of Israel, and we don't yet see that shift in Congress. I think we're going to see it, but how many people need to get killed until they finally recognize that maybe it's better to support what the American people want instead of what AIPAC and the weapons industry wants?
Medea, I think the thing that's really unbelievable to me, and it's a hard one to, you know, to stand against, but we are now seeing, we know what hungry people look like. We've seen the ribs of starving people as a result of U.S. policy and policy of other countries. We see it on the ground now. It's like the world is watching a slow motion genocide, or not so slow, and people are being starved as a nobody could tell me it's not a strategy. Starvation is really food, and starvation is really a strategy being used by the Israelis and their Americans who support them.
Well, that's right. And on top of that, they have this diabolical Gaza, quote, humanitarian foundation that kettles people in these metal fences and then shoots at them. And when we talk about Congress not representing us and the Democrats being almost as bad as the Republicans, I was just dumbfounded when Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib put out a letter, I think it was about 2 weeks ago, and held it open for quite a while, condemning the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which Amnesty condemns, the UN condemns, you know, all of the humanitarian groups condemn. And do you know, Dennis, how many people out of 535, how many of them were willing to sign on to that letter?
No.
Take
how
a
many?
Guess.
None?
19. Pathetic. One.
Well, 19 courageous people. They'll be punished in some way.
Well, but can you believe something as simple as saying that the humanitarian aid should go through the UN agencies that know how to give out the aid fairly and without causing deaths? You could
totally
only get
outrageous.
19 people? Outrageous. And, you know, a lot of progressive members of Congress wouldn't sign on to it. You know, we literally put it in their hands. You know, we dog them all the time, and we find them when they're in a hearing or when they're going to a press conference. So they can't say they didn't know about it, and still they didn't sign on to it. That just gives you an indication of how afraid these people are. And of course, one of the things they're really afraid of is signing onto something initiated by the only Palestinian American in Congress.
Wow. Well, listen, what's your best pitch? What would you love to see people do? What kinds of things do you want to share with our audience about where your struggle is now, maybe how they might want to join if they're interested?
Well, I think that there are a number of companies that came out in the report by the UN rapporteur Francesca Albanese. We need to go after those companies that are profiting from the genocide. I know people are sick and tired of contacting their congresspeople, but they should do more. You know, one of the people who wouldn't sign that letter, and I placed it in her hand, is Latifa Simon. Can you believe that? And she said, oh, I love Rashida. Yeah, sure, I'll sign that. And then never did. So contact the congresspeople. And, of course, the two senators from California are pretty pathetic. Neither of them would sign on to the War Powers Act to stop these weapons from going to Israel. So we've got to do
that. Listen, I got to interrupt you because I just noticed we're right out of time. Medea, how do people follow Code Pink if they want all the information you all are sharing?
Website, codepink.org, local group, and also on social media, Code Pink. Thank you, Dennis. Great to be on with you.
Thank you.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation